This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ken Burns has been telling Americans the story of our collective past. Even people who stared out the window daydreaming through history class were swept up in the story of the Civil War when Burns told it in his PBS documentary series. In his recent PBS series on baseball, he connected the story of how baseball changed through the decades to the story of how gender roles, civil rights, family, leisure time, cities, and suburbs changed too. The Civil War was PBS's highest-rated series. Some of Burns' earlier documentaries you may have seen on public TV include The Brooklyn Bridge, The Shakers, Huey Long, and The Statue of Liberty. In between his two blockbusters, public television showed his documentary on radio's early history, Empire of the Air. Last month, I spoke with Burns at the Flynn Theater in Burlington, Vermont, for an event sponsored by Vermont Public Radio.
Ken, I read about you that you never took history classes in college, and I thought this is pretty paradoxical.
Yeah, that's very embarrassing. Yes, I actually took a history course, but it was Russian history.
Wait. No, I didn't mean that to sound like you should be embarrassed, but I just thought it was fascinating that obviously you weren't interested in it in college, but sometime afterwards something happened that got you really interested.
It's funny, because I knew that history was what I was interested in all along, but it never got to the front of my brain. I remember as a kid being a reader of encyclopedias and almanacs and the Book of Lists and things like that, and knowing absolutely everything and getting straight A's in history all through grammar school and high school, but never really realizing that this was a love. And it took plunging myself into filmmaking and trying to figure out how to express myself in film, and all of this latent history came rushing forward, and they sort of combined, and I knew exactly what I had to do, and it's yet to really flag.
Well, you know, the Civil War and the baseball series coincided with incredible events that you obviously couldn't possibly have imagined would happen, like the invasion of Kuwait and the baseball strike. When you saw that the baseball strike was going to happen and eliminate the World Series, when you were thinking, what's in this for me?
Yeah.
Did you think this was going to be good news for your series, or that it was going to kill it?
Well, you know, I was in the middle of promotion, so the tendency was to put the kind of ad mans or the promo, the flax, good spin on it and say that we'd be the only game in town, which is exactly how the thing. But I was devastated because I really felt that the series ought to be cradled in the middle of a baseball season, that the proof of what I was saying about this had to do with the excitement that's in our bloodstream in those 6 months when we have baseball. And I think the general grumpiness in the country, not just because we have a baseball strike, though that's a major contributor, but because of the general grumpiness, I was sure made it, you know, discordant and wrong. Though it's been nice. I had calls. People called me up all during the series, when the film series was on, saying that they were 75 years old and they lived in New Orleans and they were female and they hated baseball, but they loved this and they were following it, and that was heartening.
Do you think a lot of Americans have turned against baseball now?
I guess we have, in a kind of superficial way, but I feel, as I felt while I was working on the film, there was this wonderful tension between the professional game that had brought this high level of achievement and what I called, or what we called in the editing room, the pure game that was played by kids, that's played by my daughters, that we do in the afternoon when the editing room gets, you know, too much, you go out and throw a ball around, that's always there and it will serve us. And so I have a feeling that superficially, we're really angry at the game and kind of at ourselves, because I do believe the game is a mirror of who we are. And it says horrible, the strike says horrible things about us.
One of the real amazing things about the Civil War series that I think had a huge emotional impact on viewers were the letters. And I was wondering, I don't know how far your own family dates back, but I was wondering if there were, in any branch of your family, Civil War letters that you found that had, you know, that personal connection.
My grandmother shared with me some letters that lacked any of the kind of poignancy that the ones that we had in the series showed. And you never had a sense, as you got in the rest of the letters that we saw of this impending death. I mean, war is a horrible thing, mainly because it's huge periods of tedium punctuated by extreme terror. And we forget that you can go for 99% of the time doing nothing and agonizing over that, and then all of a sudden it is sheer terror. At Cold Harbor, you know, 20,000 Union men fall, you know, in just a few minutes. It's incredible.
I don't know whether it's because I'm a woman and I was socialized this way or what, but I grew up with nothing but terror when it came to war. And I know there are some men who grow up, you know, wanting to enlist and wanting to be in that battle, and they see war as a kind of proving ground, a crucible to find out who they really are. I never, ever, for a moment, would have wanted to be on a battleground to see who I really am. But also, I mean, I came of age during the Vietnam War when everyone I knew was trying to figure out a way where they wouldn't have to go because they didn't believe in the war. And I'm not sure how old you are, but I was thinking that maybe doing the Civil War series might have completely changed your sense of war, of why men fight it, of what it's like to go through it.
We should open this series.
Were you of draft age?
I had a fairly high draft number, but I would have resisted the draft in some way. But we opened the Civil War series with a quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes: "We have shared the incommunicable experience of war. We have felt, we still feel, the passion of life to its top. In our youths, our hearts were touched with fire." Quite often we ask of ourselves in war things that we would never do, heroic things, in which perhaps the powerful and even in a funny way, ironic way, positive limits of human experience find their expression.
Okay, but you came of age during the anti-war movement, I'm sure in Ann Arbor, it's like where I was in Buffalo when I went to college, that there was this huge split between the campus community and the rest of the community.
Yes.
A lot of tension with all the cops.
Town and gown, yeah.
Town and gown, a lot of bumper stickers that said love it or leave it.
Yep.
You know, so you were part of the disaffected generation of Americans that was really questioning the whole meaning of what it meant to be an American.
That's right.
So I'm not sure how that connects exactly to actually feeling this organism and wanting to be a part of it.
See, it was all unformed. There were all these experiences that were sort of gathering, that were being attracted, and that they never had any connective tissue. I'd even dropped baseball. By 68, the Tigers won. That was the only local victory in the World Series I ever had. That was fun, but by 69, the Mets' victory was a news item. And it was wonderful because the classic underdog had won, but because of Vietnam, I was leaving baseball. And my father and my brother and I were, you know, sort of pushing away. And I went to college, nothing. But in college, I had discovered film. And then at the very end of college in 75, I had discovered history as a means of expression. My senior thesis, or the equivalent at Hampshire, was a film I made for Old Sturbridge Village. I can't begin to tell you, as if it was finding something that was so obviously my own. And then that fall, after I'd graduated, was the 75 series, and I had a friend who was a passionate Red Sox fan, and we sort of tolerated it. That was uncool. And nobody was into baseball. And then all of a sudden I realized that this was a pleasure that I could have. And in fact, it was the only pleasure that I had from childhood. And so we took it on, and that series was, of course, this fantastic series. And Carlton Fisk hit this home run at 12:34 a.m. in the sixth game, and it changed my life. I mean, I was already moving into history, and I was reacquiring the love or the sense of the country.
My guest is Ken Burns, who made the PBS documentary series on the Civil War and baseball. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview recorded last month with Ken Burns at the Flynn Theater in Vermont.
I know your mother was very sick when mm-hmm. you were growing up. Your mother, I believe, had cancer and passed away when you were 12.
11, yeah.
11. So your whole family had to be very preoccupied with that. I'm sure your father had to be very preoccupied with that. So much of baseball kind of celebrated how it brings families together, fathers and sons going the game together, fathers and sons playing catch. Did you ever get to do that with your father?
No. And that's the really peculiar thing, is that I made this film in which nearly everyone I spoke to, love of the game, and I have a passionate love of baseball, was rooted in the experience of going to a game with their parents or playing with their father or their mother taking them and getting equipment or something like that. And I didn't realize this until the last months of the production. And it's because I must shove a lot of this stuff away. My thing had to do with baseball being a refuge from what was happening to my family. This is a place where I went to escape the kind of horror that was overtaking us. And so I can remember going with friends' parents, mothers, taking me in the station wagon to the suburban, ball field and playing in the Little League teams and doing really well and having no one in my family see it. None.
Oh, they couldn't come?
No one came. And my younger brother was disinterested in baseball for the most part. I think he had tried, but it hadn't been something he liked. But my love of baseball was sort of legion in the family. People would respond to that, and I would get books, and I would get gloves and mitts, but I would do it alone. It was a place of refuge. But in some ways, as I've realized just in doing Civil War and baseball, that all of my work is about this conversation with the family. I mean, I realized my father-in-law had said to me that my whole life was waking the dead, that's what I did well.
You know, and yet there seems to be something at the heart of each of those two series that you weren't a part of. That's part
of
this collective American past, but
right. It's
not really part of yours because you didn't share baseball with your father and you never fought in a war and you wouldn't have wanted to fight in a war when you were of the age.
It's absolutely true. You know, I made two films over the last 10 years. I mean, the radio film happened as a kind of sort of hitch in the giddy up, and I really like that. But basically, over the last 10 years, I've made two films, and the irony of these two films is so palpable. The first, you could boil it down and say that in order to become one, you have to divide yourself in two. And the other's about coming home. So I think that in each one of the films, I'm acquiring a piece of something that was lacking. That I was taking baseball back to my family, that I was involving myself in a kind of heroic, purposeful action that I had never contemplated before. You hit the nail on the head.
Now, I have to just ask you, as an interviewer, I have to ask you a few things about your interviewing, because I think you get these crystallized moments in your movies where people seem to be genuinely connecting with their past and not faking it for the camera. And it's not easy to get that. And I know, for instance, one of the things that I find really difficult as an interviewer is that very often I'm interviewing somebody and they haven't really figured out yet what words they want to use to say something. And they're going on and on in this just fog of words. And somewhere in there is a crystallized thought,
that's
but they're
right.
not crystallizing it.
Right.
And what do you do when you know somewhere's in there is a story that you need them to tell you and they're not doing it in a compelling way?
I realized with horror as I was listening to your last interview that you do in a year more than I've done in 20 years of filmmaking, so I feel like I'm still learning about it, and you have a kind of calm and sort of precision at the way you sort of try to bring things back to the center when it's happening. I feel more like a sheepdog that's yapping at the edges of a vast herd of sheep, you know? And fortunately, you know, you show everything here. You know, you show your process, your questions, your reactions, the silences and everything. I have the great luxury of being able to go to an interview and do it and then cut out what works. But essentially, when I go there, I want to make sure first and foremost that it's a non-confrontational thing. We get that in journalism. Journalism thrives in conflict, and I am interested in a much more deeper. If there's conflict, it's got to be two or three levels down. And what I'm looking for is a kind of connection with the other, a kind of epiphany that every once in a while happens. The first thing that comes to mind just as I'm speaking is John Thorne, who's a baseball historian, talking about these glorious moments that he waits as a baseball fan, knowing that will come, and these little pearls that come out of the interviews. And I, as I said, I have the luxury of like taking a vast transcript and editing it down to that.
Your films have been so successful on television. I can guess what all the good aspects of the success are. Is there any, you know me, I'm always looking for the dark side of things, but are there problems that come with the success and problems that come with the marketing and the money from it and trying to figure out what's appropriate to do with it?
A little bit. In Civil War, I'd had this approach by people who wanted to merchandise stuff, and I said no, and then we got pretty badly ripped off by people who did knockoffs. So this time I decided that I would do it, but give the profits on the t-shirts and the caps to charities like the Negro League Museums, and that's a pretty tough call. You don't really know how to do it, how far to go, how mm-hmm. far to get involved.
And when you're commercializing or when it's
yeah,
a benefit.
And you want to let people know that it's not something that you want to benefit from, and yet you have to put your stamp on it, and it's a pretty confusing territory there. I've enjoyed it, just an extraordinary kind of celebrity, if you will, because it's a very complicated one and a serious one, and I value the sense. I remember 2 days after the Gulf War did start in January, 4 months after the broadcast, I was at Bowdoin College, the place where Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, this Union colonel, had gone to school and later became president. And George Mitchell was supposed to introduce me, but he couldn't. He had to stay in Washington, and his introduction came over the air, and it was freezing cold. Everybody should have been home in their living rooms watching this war happening, and there were 1,300 people in this gymnasium, and you could hear a pin drop. And the president of Bowdoin said this remarkable thing. He said, "We're here, and we're all surprised that we're here because we want to finish a conversation with Ken that we already feel that we've been having." And it was a kind of something for the audience, but it gave me probably the single greatest gift, more than any review or award or anything like that, this sense of connection. That's, what Lincoln called the mystic chords of memory and the better angels of our nature. That's what I'm interested in.
You put your heart and soul into these movies, and they operate on many different levels at the
yes.
same time. And then sometimes public television interrupts it, and I do this, I have to do this too, so I'm saying this with a great deal of understanding. So call now and make a pledge. Make it possible for more series like Ken Burns, Civil War, Ken Burns Baseball. How do you feel when your show is interrupted by fundraising breaks?
You know, I feel completely...
As I say, I do this all the time.
I'm
sure you've heard me do it, so I understand it.
I feel really hypocritical about this because I have made a big public display of saying I'm interested in public television because there's no commercial interruption and that the things that I have done play out really well without interruption, and they do. At the same time, if you notice the way I design my films, they're perfectly designed to be interrupted every 10 minutes. And, and many people after baseball sort of were welcoming that kind of interruption. We got a comment. Somebody faxed in this this cartoon that shows this bleary-eyed couple in front of a TV set, and the TV set is blaring, "Stay tuned for the O.J. Simpson story, 2,575 hours." And the and the man on the couch says to his wife, "Ken Burns has to be stopped."
We're listening to an interview with Ken Burns. Burns also took questions from the audience. Here's a question about his Civil War series on PBS.
On the Civil War, there seems to be two different outcomes depending on what part of the country you're from. The War of Northern Aggression and the Civil War. And I just wonder if you feel that you were able to get the middle of the road version, or if even indeed there is a middle of the road version.
It's a really good question. No, we took one point of view, and that was that the North won and that they were the good guys. And I have said this in Montgomery, Alabama as well, and I had to be escorted out of a church of all places. for having said that. But you're right. There are two convenient versions of who won. The one in the North is actually, I think until recently, had not been attended to. It was a garden that had not been kept up and weeded. And the other garden, which was magnificent, had tried to convince us that the South had some sympathetic features in why it fought. And you listen to people try to disguise the cause of the war, that it's not about slavery, but it's about economic or social or political differences. And they're right, but they're trying to disguise it. The social differences are made manifest in two regions of the country. One is based on slave labor and the other on wage labor. You develop culturally quite differently. Slavery's at the heart of that. There's political differences. People say it's about states' rights. Well, states' rights was an effort by mostly southern states to be able to overrule federal legislation that they might find abhorrent. And the thing that they feared most was slavery. So once again, states' rights is about slavery. And finally, this economic thing. There were certain unfair tax things, but you don't murder 2% of your own population over unfair tax things. What it was is the South feared losing its most valuable property, and that property was 4 million human beings. And finally, this country could no longer compromise, which, as Shelby Foote said, is our great genius, and we went to war and murdered 2% of our population to supposedly settle the issue, though if you're in Lexington, Kentucky tonight, you know painfully well that that issue has not been settled. And we struggle still to find out how to resolve it. But the North won that war, and they were on the right. They were opposed to slavery and for union. And those were things that I thought the documentary was fairly sure about.
Ken Burns made the Civil War and Baseball series for PBS. Our interview was recorded last month at the Flynn Theater in Burlington, Vermont, for an event sponsored by Vermont Public Radio. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.